Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Today, we're going to discuss a difficult topic. Just about everyone who works with children or youth will meet people who've been sexually abused. Many of us will also meet those who've committed the abuse. Too frequently, these are the same people. In this podcast, we're going to discuss how to work with adolescents who have sexually abused and what we can do so that it does not happen again. Today's guest is Dr. Ziggy Schuler. Dr. Schuler is the clinical director of the Halton Trauma Center. He has a private practice, teaches at the University of Toronto, as well as Ryerson University, and consults widely with hospitals, child welfare agencies, treatment programs, and detention facilities. In his work, he has developed an expertise in adolescents who sexually offend. Dr. Schuler just recently completed his PhD, congratulations, with a thesis that focused upon the role of pornography with adolescents who have sexually abused others. Welcome, Dr. Ziggy Schuler.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. When I teach students, the idea of sexual offenders or adolescents who sexually offend is one that is very, very difficult for them. In fact, it's the group that people will most often say they will not work with them, they refuse to work with them. Which raises the obvious question to me is, why should we work with adolescents who sexually offend and not just incarcerate them to stop the behavior?
Well, I think it's a really good question. I think there are certain people, who may not be able to work with this population. And I think when we get into the work with children and adolescents, we always, as professionals, need to decide, you know, what is the population of kids that we want to be able to work with, and where do we think our strengths are? And certainly, I think some issues and some behaviors are just not, you know, suited for everyone because of personal history or because of the nature of the topic. But I think, you know, that aside, I think it's really important to work with adolescents who've committed sexual offenses, in part because of the big piece around prevention. I think working with young people who have sexually abused prevents further sexual abuse of others. And we know certainly with a lot of adults who've committed sexual offenses, when we ask them about their history of sexual offending behaviors, many of them will tell us that they started the sexual offending patterns early on in age, sometimes before the age of 12. And so those who work with adolescents who've sexually harmed really see this as being a very preventative piece of work and a way to reduce the incidences of violence against kids. And also, I think a lot of these kids, I call them kids sometimes, but, you know, these adolescents who've sexually offended also have lots of other issues that they're dealing with. So trying to sometimes separate the behavior from the individual, I think, is an important strategy as well, that these kids have, these adolescents have committed, serious offenses and have some very serious behaviors that need to be dealt with. But there's also, you know, a whole other aspect to these adolescents. And many of them as well have, you know, their own histories of victimization and have other areas of concern, but also have lots of other strengths. I see these often young men, but there's also young women who have committed sexual offenses. They go off to do very important and good things in life once they've received the right kind of treatment. So I think it's just a really important area of work.
You say that some people start sexually offending before age 12. What age do you usually work with people who have abused others, sexually abused others?
Well, I mean, I think it's important in terms of language. You know, we use the term sexual offending with those who have engaged in that behavior between sort of the age, well, starting from about 12 and up, and kids under the age of 12, we generally call that behavior sexualized behaviors. And, you know, just in terms of some statistics, I mean, a lot of, like I said, a lot of the adults that we know who've committed sexual offenses as adults when we ask them, what are the ages of the onset of their sexual offending or their sexualized behaviors, you know, many of them will say, 50% of them will say before the age of 18 they've engaged in that kind of behavior. In terms of my group, generally I work with, you know, young men who are starting at the age of 12. These are the age of culpability in Canada, so as young as 12 up until 18, 19. But it's certainly myself and my practice and the agencies that I'm connected with. We work with kids as young as sometimes 4 or 5 who are engaging in concerning sexualized behavior that is beyond what would be typical for that age and stage of development. So it can be very young, and generally, you know, within children's mental health, we see up till about the age of 18, 19 sometimes, and then, you know, anything older than 19, we start to see those individuals moving into the adult system.
Right, and that's, you know, particularly a Canadian framework, the idea that not legally culpable under the age of 12, and then over the age of 18, they move into the adult, you know, particularly criminal justice system.
Right.
When we talk about sexually offending, I mean, you talk about sexualized behavior under the age of 12, and then sexual abuse or offending over the age of 12, and it's, you know, it's a somewhat arbitrary distinction based upon, you know, legal age. However, what sorts of behaviors, without getting too graphic, are we discussing when we talk about sexual offending? What does it encompass?
Well, there's the criminal code defines sexual offending certainly in very specific ways in terms of what are chargeable offenses. So, things like hands-on sexual offending, where an individual is committing a sexual assault on someone, in terms of sexual penetration, oral sex, you know, hands-on groping or touching of someone that is not, and the other person is either not in a position to be able to give consent, not at the age of consent, or they have not just given consent, so it's against their will. You know, that there's some very specific parameters and definitions within the criminal code, but certainly we see lots of different types of sexual offending behavior and sexualized behavior. So it can involve violence, so someone being held down, so sort of classically maybe, you know, what we might call as a rape. It may be in the context of a relationship, so what we might call a date rape kind of offense, or within a sibling relationship. So sometimes brothers and sisters, or fathers and brothers, may be engaged in some sort of sexual offense, a sexual abuse situation, where there is, you know, hands-on or hands-off type of sexual offending. So hands-off would be things like voyeuristic type behaviors, where an adolescent may be spying on someone else, changing, and the other person not being aware of that, or exhibitionism, where an adolescent may be, you know, flashing themselves with other people. You know, and like I said, and then the hands-on type of sexual offenses can really range from one end being groping and grabbing to penetration-type behaviors.
And do you treat those, and we'll talk about treatment shortly, but do you treat people who do that differently, whether it's a hands-off or a hands-on? In my head, I'm thinking sort of a continuum of danger to the victim, perhaps, is what I'm thinking. I don't know if that's the right way of looking at it, but I think of a continuum of behaviors. Is your approach to treatment different, whether it's a hands-on or a hands-off offense?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, when I sort of teach about this, you know, I talk about in our world that there is a continuum of seriousness, and that you know, the big caveat is that, of course, all sexual abuse and all, you know, sexual offending behavior or sexualized behavior is serious. And that one type of sexual abuse is not necessarily, for lack of a better word, better or worse than another. It's really based on, you know, an individual's experience of that violence that was put on to them. But, you know, I think in my world, that, you know, there could be an adolescent who commits what we say maybe a relatively minor sexual offense, where it's maybe a groping. Of course, for that individual, the victim, that could be very serious for them, and it is very serious, and it needs to be treated as such. But you may have that kind of experience or behavior, and then you have an adolescent who commits a very violent, aggressive, assaultive, penetration type of sexual offense, and that may be on the far end of the continuum of violence and level of intrusiveness. But, you know, in order to sort of determine, you know, what kind of treatment do we apply to anyone who's committed a sexual offense, an adolescent, what really guides us is a really comprehensive assessment that helps us to understand what are the risk issues involved. Because someone who's committed what I would say may be a relatively minor sexual offense, that individual, if we assess that individual on the surface, it may seem to be a very, you know, again, quote-unquote, minor sexual offense. But once we start to do the assessment and get an understanding of what are the thoughts and feelings behind that sexual offense, what are the other issues that adolescent may be dealing with in terms of family issues, in terms of other delinquency-type behaviors, you know, emotional and behavioral issues, mental health concerns. Once we sort of look at the big picture and sort of the complete package of the adolescent, what we might discover is that adolescent is actually at quite high risk of committing another sexual offense. So just looking at what did the adolescent do in terms of their behavior, their sexual offense behavior, you know, what got them referred to an agency or a practitioner is not necessarily a really good indicator in terms of risk. So we really need to understand what the risks are and what is the sort of complete package in terms of the other issues that the adolescent is dealing with, and that sort of helps us to shape what is the treatment plan and how long is that adolescent going to be in treatment for, versus, you know, we may have, you know, on the other side of the continuum, we may have an adolescent who committed what we might say a very serious sexual offense on the continuum of seriousness. But once we complete an assessment and we look at all of the issues that the adolescent is dealing with, we might find that, yes, the offense itself is very serious and will require some, you know, pretty intensive treatment around the sexual offense, but there are lots of things that are going well for that particular adolescent, and maybe they come from a family that is very supportive. There aren't a lot of family-based issues. That particular adolescent may have some very strong social networks, is doing well at school, is not suffering from any other, you know, mental health concerns or behavioral concerns, and maybe in general sort of quite pro-social in their functioning. And so we might determine that adolescent may require less involvement in treatment, and maybe what's really being targeted is just the sexual offense and not a lot of other areas. So it's difficult, you know, to say when just looking at the offense itself, what the treatment may involve for a particular adolescent. But what we do know is that treatment really needs to be comprehensive, and we generally understand that, you know, an adolescent who's committed a sexual offense, that the sexual offense may be a relatively small component of the overall treatment picture, that we may be spending, you know, these are some arbitrary numbers, but it just sort of gives a bit of a picture in one's mind that, you know, if I'm working with an adolescent, the actual sexual offense, the very focused sexual offense specific treatment may be 30% of the work. And the other 70% may be really around social skills development, self-esteem. It may involve, other mental health concerns that have sort of come out through the assessment. Things like depression, anxiety, other concerns, and maybe a lot of family-related issues that have really plagued this adolescent and this family. They may have, other cognitive concerns or issues that they need to be dealing with, and they may also have their own victimization history that may actually be more prominent in that adolescent's life than the actual work around the sexual offending. So it's a complicated picture often with these kids and adolescents.
So as practitioners, we certainly shouldn't diminish and say, oh, well, they were stealing underwear, they were, voyeurizing their sister or their sibling, and say, well, that's so serious, we don't really need to address that. And at the same time, we shouldn't say, well, this person, raped somebody, there's no hope for them, we should incarcerate them forever.
Exactly. It's easy to sort of say on the surface, well, that's a relatively minor sexual offense, and we should, we don't need to be so concerned about it. Certainly when I worked in custodial centers and in secure treatment, when we had adolescents come in with a sexual offense background, and some of the managers or the institution would say, in some of the places I worked, some of the adolescents would be roomed with a roommate. And when we had an adolescent come in that had a sexual offense background, sometimes decisions were made in terms of whether to have that adolescent room with a roommate or not based on the kind of sexual offense that they had. So for an example, if you had an adolescent who came in and, their offense was against a female, the institution might say, well, it's okay to have this adolescent who committed a sexual offense room with another male because their sexual offense was against the female, so they must not be a risk towards other males. Or it was against a child, so they're not going to be a risk to peers. And that's just a really bad assumption to make, and that's not necessarily true. In fact, what could be the picture is that an adolescent is also sexually aroused to violent sexual acts against peers or same-age or gendered individuals, but it's just that we don't know about that yet until we ask the question.
So the behavior is not necessarily indicative of future offenses either.
Exactly.
Okay. Is there a commonality that we see with people who sexually offend? And I'm thinking here of a past history of abuse, which you alluded to, being male, access to someone to abuse. And I don't want to get into the profiling, this is your sexual offender, and if they don't fit this, there's no risk. But are there commonalities that we see across people who sexually offend?
There's been lots of research that has now been done in terms of trying to understand those behaviors and the individual adolescents who've committed those sexual offenses and the families that some of these adolescents come from. But I still think that my belief is that the field is still quite young. We used to, and we don't so much anymore, but we used to take a lot of our information from the adult world and the adult research and try to apply it to our understanding of adolescence. And, and thankfully the field has moved along quite far in that regard, where we, have very specific research and understanding and best practices around adolescents who've committed sexual offenses. And there's some really amazing and prominent researchers who focus the time on adolescents. So trying to understand, what are the background of some of these individuals? Is there a common thread between some of their behaviors and backgrounds? I mean, we still try to put them into typologies. And certainly in the adult world, I think that that's clear in terms of trying to develop some typologies of adults who've committed sexual offenses and what are their behaviors and what are their backgrounds and, what are the similarities and that kind of thing. But with adolescents, in part because of, the developmental changes, we're just not able to do that. But I think you're right. I think there are some common threads between adolescents. For instance, certainly common that adolescents who've committed sexual offenses have their own histories of victimization. Or they may come from families where there is a lot of violence and disruption or sexualized in sort of types of environments. Or there may have been quite a bit of interest and use around sexual media or sometimes ascribe to certain thoughts about sexuality or sexual behaviors that tends to be maybe more violent or break some of those common boundaries or consent rules, or there's a lack of social skills and that kind of thing. But, you know, those are sometimes some common threads, but I would have to say in my experience as well that there are a lot of teens that I've worked with, lots of adolescents, where they don't fit some of those common threads. You know, I worked with an adolescent a number of years ago, and he's still occasionally in contact with me, where he had come from a family that was, it was a professional family. They were progressive in a sense that they were very open to having dialogue, very appropriate dialogue around sexuality and sexual health. There were a lot of very good messages in the family around respecting others and personal boundaries. The adolescent had a strong social network. They did well at school. They were pro-social. They were involved in extracurricular activities. And then he also committed a sexual offense. And it really, I knew this family quite well, and I believe that the adolescent and the family was quite honest, and they were very open to treatment, and he was very open to treatment. But it was really hard to understand where some of these behaviors came from. And I think what we in the field sometimes say is that we don't always know why these behaviors develop, but what we know more is how to make sure that they don't happen again. And what I often talk to when I speak to adolescents that I'm working with, I often talk about these bowls of ingredients. And I sort of make this analogy to baking a cake, that there are some important ingredients that come together that I believe play a part in the background of an adolescent who commits a sexual offense. So, and sometimes I quite literally do this, or I sort of draw it out on paper, that you may have this bowl of that represents the family background, another bowl around self-esteem and sexual development and emotional health, you know, sexual thoughts and feelings and puberty, and, you know, all of the sort of things that you might think would be important in terms of functioning that might be in the background of an adolescent. And, you know, we fill these bowls with all of the things that may be concerning. And, you know, and I talk about that these bowls represent those ingredients. And just like baking a cake, you know, without flour, you're not going to get the cake. Without eggs, you're not going to get the cake. And without milk and so on. And that you have to combine these ingredients and create a batter, and that mixing these ingredients up play a really important part in the potential development of sexual offending behaviors. But it's once you have the mixture, the batter, that itself is not considered cake. That it requires the adolescent to place the batter into a mold and put it into the oven and turn on the oven. And that there's some conscious decisions that the adolescent needs to make in order to proceed to the actual act of committing a sexual offense. So many of us, and many teenagers, may have those exact same ingredients, but they're not all committing sexual offenses. So while, you know, having a victimization history like sexual abuse is a common factor in adolescents who've committed sexual offenses, it's part of many of those adolescents' background, but, you know, many individuals who have experienced sexual abuse don't go on to commit sexual offenses. So you may have 50 to 80% of adolescents, depending on the study and the paper, you may have 50 to 80% of adolescents who've committed sexual offenses have some sort of victimization history, sexual abuse, emotional, physical abuse, or a combination of all three in their background. But when we look at individuals who are victims of sexual abuse, we know that 50 to 80% of them aren't committing sexual offenses. Actually, the number is quite small. So we know that some of these things individually are not causal factors, and that mixing up these ingredients, as I describe it, doesn't cause, quote-unquote, a sexual offense either. But that what the adolescent also needs to understand is that there are some decisions that they're making in terms of setting up or organizing the potential to do a sexual offense, to commit a sexual offense. And that's the act of, you know, to use the analogy again, of putting the batter into the oven.
So the adolescent has, you know, put the batter into the oven. They've committed this sexual offense. There's not clarity necessarily on the reason a particular adolescent puts the batter into the oven, another reason, you know, another one does not. What you did say, though, is there's a lot of clarity about how to prevent it from happening again. What is the evidence-based treatment for sexual offenders?
You know, there's some very clear guidelines. You know, the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, ATSA, is an organization out of the U.S., but it, you know, has roots in Canada as well, and they're an organization that promotes research and education and best practices around assessment and treatment and professional standards. You know, they talk about the importance of a comprehensive approach to treatment. And as I mentioned earlier, when we think about adolescents who've committed sexual offenses, it's not just the sexual offense. That the treatment plan is very comprehensive. The adolescent isn't just the sexual offense. That there are many other things that are going on in their lives, like these bowls of ingredients that play an important part in reducing risk around future sexual offending and hopefully prevention of future sexual offending that really need to be addressed. You know, there's the one component, the obvious component around the sexual offense-specific treatment, and often that's a cognitive behavioral-based treatment. And some people term it as well as a relapse prevention component of the larger treatment. So we look at some of the precipitating factors that started the ball rolling in terms of the sexual offending behaviors. What are some of the background things? What are the thoughts and feelings that led to the adolescent committing the sexual offense? What are some of the prevention plans? Really looking at their arousal patterns and helping them address the inappropriate sexual arousal patterns, but also helping them develop new and healthy ways of expressing themselves sexually and engaging in healthy sexual relationships. So there's lots of work around consent and navigating relationships and safety planning that really goes into the very specific components around the sexual offense piece. But then the other piece is really all of those other things that we know to play a very significant role around prevention. And it's looking at, you know, the areas like the family history and self-esteem and social skills development, emotional regulation, and addressing those other mental health concerns, getting these adolescents involved in the community. So it's being helping them to be, you know, pro-social, looking at the prevention kind of strategies, helping them feel good about who they are, and helping their families as well work with their adolescents differently in different kind of communication styles within the family. So it's a very comprehensive look at the treatment. Sometimes that's involved on an outpatient, you know, sort of community-based agency where an adolescent and their family would go into an agency once a week, where they're getting individual family and sometimes group treatment. Sometimes the more severe cases, we have adolescents who will be involved in residential treatment-based counseling. So they're in residence, and they're in a residence where it's an offense-specific treatment modality. You know, then they would receive 24 hours a day, 7 days a week treatment related to their sexual offending, but also, you know, those other areas as well that I've described, those other areas of functioning. And that tends to be, you know, we see adolescents in that kind of treatment modality probably for, you know, maybe a year or a bit in residential, and then we see that kind of adolescent moving into a community-based outpatient service for the remainder.
Once the adolescent has gone through treatment, the prognosis that they will cease the sexual offending?
Well, there's some pretty good research now as well around that. And there was recently, there was a 10-year follow-up study on, so this was a research study conducted by Dr. James Worling and his colleagues through the safety program in Etobicoke. And they did both a 10-year and a 20-year follow-up on, you know, a fairly large group of adolescents that went through their community-based treatment program. And in the 20-year follow-up, they found that only 9%, I think I have the numbers right, I think about 9% of the participants in the study who completed treatment successfully reoffended in the future, versus 21% of those who didn't complete the treatment that they were following. So those are significant differences. In their 10-year follow-up, it was 5% in the completed treatment group that reoffended, and almost 18% in the group that didn't complete treatment. So we know that treatment works, but treatment needs to be evidence-based. It needs to follow best practices. It needs to be comprehensive. And we also know that it needs to follow a comprehensive assessment that, you know, also needs to follow some very specific guidelines that's, you know, evidence-based.
You've developed, in conjunction with a couple of your colleagues, a really wonderful document around the evidence-based practices, so not just the evidence-based treatment, but the protocol around that. And I'm going to link to that document from the website. So I encourage everyone who wants to look at the more comprehensive picture to pull that document. And there's many, many, many wonderful resources in that document. As we start to move towards ending our conversation today, I started by saying many students choose not to, or would refuse to, or would not like to go in this field, and you echoed that there's certain people who it's, you know, may not be the appropriate field. You have chosen to work in this field. You've been working in this field for many years. How do you take care of yourself so that you can continue to have compassion and continue on in this work?
Yeah, it's a good question. In part, I think, you know, again, I do the work because I know it's making a difference in terms of prevention. If we're not working with them, we know through the research that we need to start early, and early has some of the best results in terms of reducing future sexual violence in our communities and in our society. So working with the under-12s and working with the adolescents, I think, is a critical piece. So that brings me lots of professional satisfaction or personal satisfaction that I'm making a real difference in terms of reducing future sexual violence. But I think, you know, burnout and issues around vicarious trauma, I think, is a really real thing in our work. So trying to make sure that my own personal life, you know, I have things, you know, that reduce stress and that help to change my focus as well, that I have a family that, you know, I adore, and I have a very supportive wife who's also in the field. You know, she and I, we often are able to, you know, debrief and talk about a little bit about our work, but we also, you know, support each other in terms of making sure that we're not talking about the work, and that we try to focus on other things that, you know, help to reduce stress and keep us connected with our family and, you know, our own social relationships and that kind of thing. The other piece of it as well is that I think working with really strong and competent and very supportive colleagues, I owe lots of my experience and support and work in the field to my colleagues who, you know, we have lots of laughs, believe it or not, in the work, and we support each other and we bounce things off of each other and we make sure that we're okay. So I think that's having a very supportive set of colleagues and workplace environment, I think, is critical. And the other piece is that it's not the only work that I do. So I find that doing other work with adolescents, I think, is really important too. You know, I have an interest in working with adolescents who are elite athletes, and so it gives me a very different perspective on teenagers that I think is healthy and helps to vary my work a bit, making sure that I do things like exercise and take care of myself emotionally and physically. I do some teaching as well, which I think is a way to give back and to help other practitioners get into the field. But again, it varies my work and gives me a different perspective.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking on this difficult topic and to committing as much time, energy, and years of service. Many, many people don't. And I think it's crucial work. So with that, I would like to say thank you very much, Dr. Ziggy Schuler. And as I said, I'll be linking to some of your work, as well as your private practice, so that anybody who's interested in dealing with these or elite athletes who want some support can contact you directly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.